What you're about to experience is one man's quest to see beyond the tumultuous period we're in and to envision what lies just beyond our grasp, yet well within our reach. Welcome to Larry Rifkin's America Trends, where the future has arrived, and it's just in time.
Welcome back to America Trends. Larry Rifkin along with John Krofcik. And John, an issue that's been in the news, of course, the big I word, impeachment. To impeach or not to impeach? That is the question. And a lot of people might think that that is the only remedy when a president has gone amok, abused the office, or, performed high crimes and misdemeanors, whatever that means. Nobody quite understands exactly what that means. But there are many ways to get rid of a president. You know that.
Well, I just think people are tired. I know I'm tired. And I can't go through another 2 years of just garbage. You know, so I wish we'd somehow learn to at least work together a little bit and get some stuff for the American people done. And I don't know. What to do about the Mueller investigation. They came out and really didn't find a way to...
Well, he was pretty clear the other day about obstruction of justice. But having said that, I mean, I'd like to take it away because with our trends, I mean, what we try to do is look at the longer view and the larger picture. And sometimes we need to put things in historical context. And so what we're doing on this podcast, so folks, don't think we're just talking about Donald J. Trump because we're all tired to death of talking about Donald J. Trump. We're talking about the process. Because it's not only Donald J. Trump. We've had Andrew Johnson. We've had Bill Clinton. Obviously, Richard Nixon. I mean, so we've had many presidents in the past who Congress, which really is Article 1 of the Constitution,
absolutely,
they're really the branch that is supposed to be most powerful and work on our behalf because they're closest to the people. What remedy do they have when an executive has gone amok? The one thing I will say is, and this is something that's been going on for the last several presidencies, this notion of the imperial presidency,
yes,
where once you give an inch, then the next president says, well, I don't want to just do signing statements, which means that I'm only going to implement certain parts of a law. I'm just going to ignore the whole law and pretend it doesn't exist and write my own rules.
That's wrong. I mean, the Congress is our lawmakers, and we can't. We can't not follow the law. I mean, the law, if it's a bad law, we need to get rid of it.
Right. And I mean, we rely on the third branch to be the referee in a lot of these things. But let's be honest, look at the founders' design, how brilliant it was. Because they said, look, we're not going to allow anybody to stay in office for more than 4 years consecutively. And then you get another shot at it. And so that's the ultimate way to get rid of a president, is to vote them out of office.
Right.
But there are so many other ways. And that's why I wanted to do this podcast. And I got to tell you, he's really almost become a friend because I've been communicating with him. And he, I know, is really looking forward to us engaging with you on social media about this particular podcast. His name is David Priest, and he's written a book called How to Get Rid of a President. And as you recall, I said to him, well, there are 50 ways to lose your leader.
And slip out the back, Jack.
Right, Jack. Make a new plan, Stan. I mean, there's lots of different ways. And that's why I think you're going to find this particular podcast to be fascinating. Because I am certain, John, that there are things we talk about in this podcast that have never occurred to people about how we either take certain powers away from a president, how we neuter them. I mean, short of impeachment, and let's be honest about it, folks, there has never been an impeachment that has gone to conviction. We can look at Richard Nixon and say that obviously the impeachment process forced him to resign, but we didn't take it to the final measure. We never have.
Well, I think Congress needs to take its power back from the president and do what it's supposed to do. And, you know, then if they got the votes to override, then they can do that. There's so much they can do, as we learn on this podcast. But to me, Congress is asleep at the wheel, and the Senate is asleep at the wheel. Everybody's just going along.
Yeah, and I'll tell you, America's falling behind rapidly. There's one presidential candidate, Tim Ryan from Ohio, who he's not going to win the nomination. But, I mean, he's really reminding us that while we're bickering, arguing over and over and over again, the Chinese, not because we want their example or their governance, but they're planning for the future.
Oh, sure they are.
They're going forward. And we're stuck. We can't get an infrastructure, but we can't get a lot of things. But we also have to protect the constitutional checks and balances. So it's a very difficult situation in America today. Having said that, you are going to learn things about how do you preemptively take a president out. Now, what does that even mean? Well, we're going to unveil a lot of really interesting approaches to this idea that the executive can be overruled and turned out of office in many different ways, perhaps even before they get into office. And you may be scratching your head saying, what does that mean? Well, that's why you listen. America Trends, David Preece, How to Get Rid of a President. With us on the line on America Trends, David Preece, and the book is called How to Get Rid of a President, History's Guide to Removing Unpopular, Unable, or Unfit Chief Executives. And by the way, David, I thought another great title would be 50 Ways to Lose Your Leader.
If it were 50 ways, then it would be a much longer or a much shallower book, and I'm not sure either one would be worth it.
But I've got to tell you, there are so many more ways that you present than most people consider when they imagine this idea of a leader not serving out their term. I mean, you tell us of things that we don't even consider part of that process, one being a preemptive takeout. And I guess Edmund Muskie and even Hillary Clinton might be good examples of that in our history.
Well, I appreciate you noticing that, because that was deliberate. When I started thinking about this project back in 2016, I thought impeachment has already been covered somewhat, and little did we know in the intervening 2 years how many other books would be coming out talking about impeachment. So I looked a little bit more widely and looked at all the ways that we have removed, using a very wide definition, all the ways that we have removed presidents in the past. And sure enough, it's everything from elections to the more notorious method of deciding that somebody might be really good as president, might be hard to remove by any other means, and so you simply preemptively remove them and take them out before they even reach office in the first place.
Then, of course, even the renomination process is something that you point to, and I don't think many of us thought about that, but look at Lyndon Johnson back in 1968. I mean, he evidently really wanted to be president. I mean, a man who had as much political ambition and drive as he did, it's hard to imagine him stepping aside.
That's the story that surprised me researching this, is what I had always heard about Lyndon Johnson was that he had decided in 1968 to step away from office and not seek renomination. In fact, told a national audience on the television on March 31st, 1968, that he would not seek and would not accept the nomination of his party because he wanted to focus on the awesome duties of his office, notably trying to get out of Vietnam. But in digging into the research, I found he was trying behind the scenes to be the Democratic Party hero that the convention would call on when they couldn't settle on anybody else. But he didn't signal that clearly enough to the delegates. The delegates didn't signal clearly to him that they really wanted him. And so it ended up being one of those what-ifs in history.
Of course, the idea of assassination, which is not something that we want to come to the forefront of our lips, but that has been a method, let's be honest about it, in, what, four different cases?
Absolutely. We can't deny it. It is our history that some people have chosen to remove the president by force, but it's just wrong. That's one person taking upon himself or herself the will of 300 plus million people. I mean, it's not the way to do it. And in fact, the beauty of our system, such that it is we do have such a diverse range of ways of getting rid of a leader when they are not able or they're not fit, or even if they're just unpopular, that fall short of violence. This is what makes our system great, and actually what has made the greatest experiment in political philosophy put into action almost 250 years ago. This is what has made it work, is we don't crumble apart as a society and kill each other when we disagree on a particular leader. Hopefully, it stays that way.
Yeah. Well, when we look at the four-year term, what was it the framers were looking at in that regard? I mean, they thought that election, re-election, and the ability to get a hold of the leader pretty quickly, I mean, 4 years is not a long stretch of time, that really was the best remedy. Do it at the polls, correct?
Yeah. The Constitutional Convention back in 1787 raised a whole bunch of these issues of how are we going to not only structure the government, but how are we going to give enough power to the executive to do what needs to be done? Because at the time, the country was operating under the Articles of Confederation, which had effectively no executive structure that was independent enough to do the things that needed to be done. How are you going to get an executive that was powerful enough to do that, but not so powerful that they would oppress the people and restrict their rights, which, frankly, the founders saw whenever they looked at a case in history similar to this. So they decided, yeah, let's have a single executive in the person of the president, and let's come up with a way of getting rid of him. And that was not guaranteed. Some of the people were talking about having essentially a president for life, or having a president with no end term except if the Congress decided that they weren't doing their job well. Thankfully, wiser heads prevailed, and we got to a term that was determined to be long enough, 4 years, that the president could actually do some things and get some initiatives completed, but not so long that it would do undue damage to the republic if it were a bad president. But a four-year term has worked pretty well overall for that, because we have had 10 presidents removed after 4 years when they were on the ballot to run again. But we've also had many presidents who ran again, and they got the thumbs up from the American people, who said, we'll give you another 4 years. And then, of course, one, Franklin Roosevelt, got elected four times to be president because the American people kept wanting him in office.
Well, George H.W. Bush is a modern reminder of that. Jimmy Carter, who is now turned into the oldest ex-president we have ever had. And we are reminded that they actually, in hindsight, are looked upon as decent people, some more effective perhaps than others. But at that moment in time, George H.W. Bush seemed to be really filling out another term of Ronald Reagan to some. And then Jimmy Carter, as you look back at Jimmy Carter, what do you see there, David?
Well, the American people definitely were looking for a change from the status quo, and in a way that got some similarities to 2016. And Jimmy Carter, even though he himself was an outsider candidate in 1976 and surprised people by winning the Democratic nomination and then vaulting to the presidency, he had been in power for 4 years. There had been some economic malaise. There, of course, had been the Iranian hostage crisis. And it looked like a stagnated, weak presidency, even though he had begun a defense buildup and some other things. So then comes Ronald Reagan with a message of hope and a message of greatness, and the American people seemed ready for that change. But it doesn't necessarily mean that there was an objective criterion for removing Jimmy Carter. The public doesn't work that way. We don't rate presidents based on a scorecard that we all agree to. We take a very subjective view of the presidency, and sometimes it's just because we like somebody else. And I think Bill Clinton showed that in 1992 as well. People were a little tired of George H.W. Bush, as classy as he was and as great of a resume as he had for the presidency. A lot of people were just looking for a change, and Bill Clinton represented that in the same way, to a lesser degree, Ronald Reagan did back in 1980.
With a bit of an assist from Ross Perot, but that's a whole nother issue. Let me ask you about the whole idea of removal in place. Again, I don't think many of us, and those who listen to this podcast, I'm sure, are thinking more politically than others, but removal in place isn't something we think about often. What is that process about, and how often has that really effectively taken place?
Sure. The more formal, if you will, methods of removing a president are, of course, voting them out, you could have the party simply not renominate them, which used to happen all the time in the 1800s, but less often now. You could have them impeached. You could use the 25th Amendment to declare a disability. Those are all ways that a president can be removed by a policy or a procedure or an action. But there's something that's a half step short of formal removal, but still accomplishes the same purpose of limiting what a bad president can do to the country. And I called that the removal in place or being undermined. And that could be done by opponents politically, or it could be done by actual subordinates. By opponents, one of the best cases I write about is the story of Andrew Johnson, who came after Abraham Lincoln and did some policies that Abraham Lincoln would not have done. And so what did the Congress do? They boxed him in. They started passing legislation that restricted the powers of the president. In fact, one of them was later ruled unconstitutional, but it said that the president could not even replace some of his own cabinet secretaries. The conflict over that led to Johnson's impeachment, not his removal, but the very act of impeachment and his negotiations not to be removed did moderate his behavior. So in a sense, undermining him, restricting his power, did make Johnson, if not a good president, certainly a less bad president. But Larry, it doesn't have to be opponents who do this. I was amazed by how many times in history it's been the president's own men who have done this. In the Nixon administration, there were chiefs of staff and even the national security advisor who either ignored the president's orders and did not execute them, or did things in the president's name. That is, removing some of the powers of the presidency at the margins. More recently, we've seen this in some of the reports about the Trump presidency. Yes. When we saw the book last year from Bob Woodward, Fear, when he talked about an economic advisor taking a memo off of the president's desk so he could not sign it. That's not what the founders had in mind with a unitary executive. And yet we see signs that perhaps there are people within the administration itself trying to do a removal in place whereby the president does not have the full power of the presidency and the full faith that his own people in office will execute his policies.
David Preece is with us. The book is called How to Get Rid of a President: History's Guide to Removing Unpopular, Unable, or Unfit Chief Executives. And David, as we look at this, of course, I have avoided for about 15 minutes impeachment. And that's on a lot of people's lips these days. Now, let's talk about that process. Let's talk about the framers and the thought as to how, why, and when someone should be removed. And of course, I think in your subtitle, Unpopular, Unable, or Unfit, some of those considerations do go into the mix. We also have that term, or that block of words, crimes and
high crimes
and misdemeanors. I mean, that to many might seem as if, you know, there's a difference between a high crime and a misdemeanor.
Right. There's a lot of debate over this, and I did talk to some constitutional scholars and experts on this to make sure that my reading wasn't outside the mainstream on this. And there are two basic points. One is that impeachment is the preferred method to remove a president when the people, through their representatives, decide that this president is so unfit for office because he or she has committed treason, bribery, or high crimes and misdemeanors, that waiting until the next election just isn't going to work, that the president needs to be, in a sense, indicted for a crime and then removed if the Senate gives it a two-third vote. That is the constitutional procedure. So when I hear people talking these days about we need to avoid a constitutional crisis of impeachment or using the nuclear option of impeachment, it's literally in the Constitution. It is not an extra constitutional action. It's what the founders had in mind for a situation of an unfit president. So that's impeachment overall. The second thing are those three listed reasons to impeach a president. One is treason, and that's defined in the Constitution very narrowly, such that it would be hard to imagine in today's circumstance. It involves an actual situation of wartime, for example, and actual witnesses to the crime, because that's the way they used to think back then. Bribery is pretty straightforward as well. High crimes and misdemeanors was a phrase that was added during the Constitutional Convention when one of the delegates had proposed having a condition for impeachment being something he called maladministration, or basically bad governance, the president just not doing a good job. And there were objections to that, saying, wait, if the president can be removed just because people don't like how he's executing his job, essentially the president would be serving at the will of Congress and could be kicked out of office routinely. Let's give it something more specific. And so they went to high crimes and misdemeanors, which was not debated, but based on the language of the times, appears to be high, meaning matters of state, something that is not a personal offense, but something that affects the actual fabric of the country. But it need not be only a crime. It need not be something that is a criminal statute, but could be something short of that if it does affect the fabric of the country. What that actually means is up to the interpretation of the House of Representatives when they decide to impeach a president, and then the Senate when they decide whether or not that warrants removal from office. To this day, nobody knows exactly what it means because there is no standard definition. It's going to depend on the will of the Congress at the time.
And we've never done it. I mean, we've come as close as a resignation in the face of impeachment, but we've never carried it out as to a conviction.
The way I look at it, Larry, is we've had one president removed by the impeachment process, and that was Richard Nixon, because he would not have resigned if the impeachment process were not moving forward and if he was not hearing from his supporters on Capitol Hill that not only was it certain that he would be impeached by the House of Representatives, but it was looking all but certain that he would be removed by two-thirds of the senators, the threshold needed to remove a president. So he was not formally impeached and removed, but that was the method that got him to resign. Two other presidents were impeached. I mentioned Andrew Johnson earlier. And then more recently, we've all heard of Bill Clinton's impeachment. Now, the impeachment itself is simply an indictment. That is saying that the president has committed these crimes according to a majority of the House of Representatives, but then his guilt needs to be assessed by the Senate. The impeachment itself is meant to be a rebuke. It's meant to be a slap across the face saying, Mr. President, whatever you're doing, don't do this anymore. But we've lost that sense because Bill Clinton fought against the impeachment charges and his popularity ratings went up during the trial in the Senate. I think before it started, he was somewhere in the low 50s in terms of popularity and approval numbers. And when the Senate was debating it and was about to acquit him of the charges, his approval rating was up near 70%. Well, the lesson that's been learned from that politicians today is if you impeach a president and you fail to remove him, you have failed politically and the president wins. That's not the original meaning. And perhaps we need to go back to the idea that there is something short of the formal removal of the president that the Congress can do to rebuke him. And impeachment seems to be the means for doing that.
What about censure?
A censure has some interesting historical debates on it. When the first president's censures were being debated, we're going back now to Andrew Jackson and John Tyler, so we're looking at almost 200 years ago, there was some debate over whether it was constitutional at all. Andrew Jackson made the point that the word censure is not in the Constitution. The Congress can pass laws, and the Congress can do things like approve treaties in the Senate, but there's nothing in there that says the Congress has the right to censure a president. He basically said, if you're going to come at me, you have to try to impeach me and remove me because that's what the Constitution allows you to do. Now, they went ahead and did it anyway, and future presidents were censured as well. It doesn't have any legal weight to it. It's merely a way of Congress expressing its opinion to say, we don't like what you're doing, Mr. President. It certainly doesn't carry the same weight constitutionally as an impeachment, and it really has no penalty to it. The president can shrug it off, as Jackson did, and say, I don't care. A president can't do that with an impeachment because he has to have himself defended in the Senate, acting as a court for his guilt or innocence on charges that could remove him from office.
I want to go back to impeachment, and then I want to get on to the 25th Amendment. But I want to look at what Nancy Pelosi just said in the context of what you said about Bill Clinton. In other words, if you only wound him and you don't take him out and remove him, then you've given him something that he might want, which is political martyrdom in the process. But beyond that, is it not in the opposition party's favor and to their benefit to leave a beleaguered, wounded, desperate person in place if an election is coming up? So again, I'm taking the high-mindedness out of this, saying very politically, isn't it better to let's go to the next election, because you do face the prospect that you're not going to capture him, and it's better to go with him into a general election than it is perhaps somebody who is less in the crosshairs and less wounded, like a Mike Pence? I mean, I'm just asking, is that a very practical consideration on her part? It may not be the best thing for the Republic, but do they really think about the best thing for the Republic or for their party in this case?
I think both are true. I think you will have some representatives and senators who are thinking about the text of the Constitution and what's best for the country, and many who are thinking of the stark politics of it. Listen, in terms of the stark politics, you're absolutely right, which is a failed impeachment after the Bill Clinton episode sure looks like it empowers the sitting president. And if it's in the first term, which the Bill Clinton impeachment was not, it was in his second term and he could not run again. But if it's in the first term, it could be a talking point on the campaign trail for re-election. So that is a valid concern. Two reflections on that. First of all, to the extent that there is strong evidence of treason or bribery or high crimes and misdemeanors, then it seems incumbent upon the Congress to at least have impeachment hearings and investigate it. Because if you take the logic to the extreme that politics trump the actual Constitution, then you could say that the president could commit treason, could commit bribery, could commit other high crimes. But if his approval ratings are too high, it's just not worth it. We can run against him in the next election. And that's not right. That's what the Constitution is there for. On the other hand, it does make you wonder if you have to stretch the meaning of high crimes and misdemeanors so much that it doesn't look real anymore. An example back from the first successful impeachment was Andrew Johnson. One of the articles of impeachment against Johnson was essentially, not these words, but the idea that Andrew Johnson was going out in public and saying mean things about Congress. Well, that's not anywhere close to a high crime and a misdemeanor, and it did not lead to the removal of Andrew Johnson. But even there, politics mattered, because the Republicans knew they had Ulysses Grant waiting in the wings for the next election, and it looked certain that he would win no matter what happened on the other side. Whether Andrew Johnson was nominated or not, Ulysses S. Grant was going to be the next president. Did they really want to throw a wrench in that? Did they want to take a chance that if they did remove Andrew Johnson and somebody else would be acting as president until the next election, that that would somehow change the dynamic and they would not win with U.S. Grant in the next election? Politics certainly do matter.
Nancy Pelosi again. She's looking at the election coming upon us. And in fact, is it better for the Democrats to push a positive agenda that they can run on? And looking at the last election where he lost by 3 million popular votes and he's never polled above 50%, does the way that somebody's gotten into office in terms of how substantial their election victory was tell us anything historically about the likelihood that they might be subjected to this kind of scrutiny from Congress?
Right. The presidents who have been elected through the Electoral College, but not with a popular majority, generally lose. George W. Bush did not. He lost the popular vote in 2000, but won in the Electoral College. And he did win his reelection in 2004, just barely. But generally, presidents who come in a sense, as a minority president, do not do well if they run for reelection. In some cases, it's not even a close one. But it's not the dominant factor, because so many things happen during a presidential term that voters look at. It can be the economy, which seems to be, if not the primary indicator of votes and the best predictor of elections, certainly one of the main indications. There can be foreign policy crises. There can be scandals. And Lordy, we've had scandals. So there are plenty of factors that go into this. I can't say that Nancy Pelosi's political judgment is wrong on this, but she did leave herself an open door. She did not say, we will not under any conditions impeach Donald Trump. She essentially said, we're not going to look at impeachment right now. We need to see what develops. Let's focus on other things. If that's what they've decided, then that leaves the door open if other information comes to light that can be the source of impeachment hearings.
The 25th Amendment, because I think a lot of us probably don't understand it, should we go back to the War of 1812 to figure out what happens if a president gets taken and held captive? Should we go back to John Wilkes Booth, who wanted really to kidnap Lincoln? It took us a long time to get to the 25th Amendment, but explain what the antecedents might have been for this.
Sure. There are a couple of parts to the 25th Amendment, one of which is more relevant to the removing a president's side. The part that isn't as relevant but was very important is codifying in the Constitution the fact that when the president vacates the office for any reason, that the vice president actually becomes the president. When John Tyler suddenly inherited the White House after William Henry Harrison died, the first president to die in office, some people said he was only the acting president and did not actually inherit the full position, but only could inherit the duties of the office. John Tyler insisted he was president, and by custom, that's what happened going forward, but it was not technically part of the Constitution that way until the 25th Amendment. The other part of it that is relevant to removing a president is the Section 3 and Section 4 of the amendment, which says if the president is unable to perform the duties of the office, the president can be removed. In Section 3, the president can remove himself by writing a letter to the leaders of Congress and saying, I temporarily give power to the vice president until my disability is lifted. Section 4, that can be the vice president and a majority of the cabinet deciding to do it against the president's will. Usually this is interpreted as a response to the Kennedy assassination and to Dwight Eisenhower's heart attacks, where, yes, the vice president probably would take over and do the job if the president went into a coma, but it was not in the Constitution that that could happen. So they made it part of the Constitution to give a method for doing this. But it's going to be really hard to use a 25th Amendment to remove a president who is physically conscious and able to communicate clearly and say, I'm okay, because it's going to look like the vice president performing a coup, looking at the president and saying, I want your job. Even if that's not the case, that's certainly how it's going to look to many observers, including the president himself.
Or to those who've watched too much House of Cards. How much should the vice presidential selection process affect what we've learned throughout our history? In other words, now they're talking about one presidential candidate who might nominate someone in advance of the, the actual nominating process. I mean, what should go into the mind of a presidential candidate about whether the person that I'm selecting may be too ambitious or may be too politically popular? I mean, do you think it has any practical consideration in that process?
The political science research is pretty consistent, which is that the choice of a vice president, while we give a lot of attention to it for a few days when the president, presidential candidate names the vice presidential nominee, it does not hit the top of voters' reasons for voting for or against a ticket. It can have an effect in that vice president's home state. And in fact, most times in history, over 200 years, when presidents select a vice presidential nominee, they do it as a balancing thing on the ticket, usually geographically, sometimes ideologically to help satisfy factions within the party, sometimes to appeal to new constituencies. But the main reason is for that geographical balance. If you have a candidate from a part of the country that you're not from, it might be able to help you pick up a few votes in that area. What we'd like to see, of course, is a presidential candidate say, look, I'm going to pick a vice presidential candidate based on who is best suited for the job. The original Constitution had people vote for who they thought was the best president, and whoever got the second highest number of votes became the vice president. That is, the person who the next highest group of people thought was best suited to be president would win. That didn't work as soon as we started getting parties and people were running on tickets. So now we elect the ticket, and we seem to have lost that somewhat. Is the idea is not that John McCain thought that Sarah Palin was the best qualified person in the country to be president if he was not.
Thank you for saying that.
Other factors took over. But it would be nice to return to a sense of that, especially for somebody like Joe Biden, who is of a certain age, and there is a reasonable possibility that in 4 or 8 years, if he were to win office, that the chance of him dying of natural causes is frankly higher than a much younger candidate. That alone would point to the fact that his vice presidential nominee should at least be someone who there is great confidence can execute the powers and duties of the office effectively and is not just a regional balancing member of the ticket.
Just a few more questions. Should we ever imagine that the 25th Amendment will be used? And how important was the fact that things happen in warp speed that might not have occurred, you know, centuries ago in terms of needing somebody to make a determination about incoming, if you will, with the red button and all? How important was that with Birch Bayh and others as they considered all of this?
Oh, Larry, that was huge. That was a huge factor because we have had incapacitated presidents before. One of my surprises researching the book was finding details and then writing the stories of Grover Cleveland, who had oral surgery to remove cancer and was effectively incapacitated for more than a week. Woodrow Wilson, who had a massive stroke and for most of the final 2 years of his presidency was effectively incapacitated. And for a time, his wife and doctor seemed to be running the country in his place. Now, we could get away with that before the nuclear age. But at a time when missiles could be flying in and someone needs to press that figurative red button you mentioned, you can't have a president who you're unsure whether they are lucid or not when they are the only one allowed to take certain actions. So yes, in the late 1960s, Birch Bayh led the effort to get the 25th Amendment passed, and it has been used. It has been used 3 times, but it was Section 3 that was used, which was the president deciding, I need to temporarily hand power over to my vice president. It happened with Ronald Reagan and it happened with George W. Bush, where they were going into surgery and they decided to pass the baton temporarily to the vice president. It has not been used through Section 4, which is the, in a sense, the unwilling removal of the president. I'll tell you, if there is a president who has fallen into a coma, then I think the application of the 25th Amendment is easy. No one will fault the vice president for saying that the president is unable to perform the duties because he's literally unconscious and we cannot wake him up. If the president is sending some odd tweets or is golfing too much, I very much doubt that any vice president would be able to cite that as an inability to perform the duties of the office. The interesting questions come in between. I think given the dynamics, it would be very hard for any vice president to look in the eyes of a president, especially a vice president like Mike Pence looking adoringly in the eyes of Donald Trump, and say, Mr. President, you say you're okay, but I say you're unfit for office. I'm taking over. It would probably take something very dramatic, like Donald Trump announcing that he's firing his entire cabinet and replacing them with farm animals, something like that, that was a clear sign of delusional thinking. Short of that, the 25th Amendment is probably a dead letter.
I guess you didn't see Facebook today because that was posted. No, I'm only kidding.
Oh, dear.
Let me ask you in closing, how much does the imperial presidency affect the way we should think about removal? The framers imagined a rather weak executive with a dominant Congress. Should that have any bearing at all?
It should not, because the text of the Constitution is the same with minor adjustments. But we can't pretend that it doesn't factor into it. I can make an argument either way. I can make an argument that because the American people know that the presidency has so much power that they should factor it into their vote, and we have to assume that the people factor it into their vote when selecting a president. I can also make the argument that given the massive accrual of power to the presidency, especially in recent decades, that it makes sense for Congress to be even more attuned to issues of presidential fitness than they have been in the past. Listen, we could get away with Franklin Pierce not being a good president for 4 years. Yes, it exacerbated some of the conflict that led to the Civil War, and that's not a good thing, but the country was not going to dissolve because of Franklin Pierce not doing a very good job. In today's day and age, with all of the powers that the presidency has, you could imagine a scenario where much more damage could be done to the fabric of the constitutional republic therefore, institutionally, you'd expect to see Congress taking a closer look at these issues. We're not really seeing that, though. Lately, we've been seeing partisanship trumping checks and balances in terms of the primary role of members of Congress. That may change, though. It certainly changed during Watergate, when people thought that Nixon had the support of Congress and he could never be at risk. And then all of a sudden, in the summer of 1974, it was clear that Congress, including Republicans, was stepping up and saying, no, this president is unfit for office.
David Priest, I can't thank you enough. This has been a fascinating tour of how to get rid of a president, history's guide to removing unpopular, unable, or unfit chief executives. Thank you so much for being with us today on America Trends.
It's been a pleasure to chat with you, Larry. Thank you.
America Trends podcast is part of the MHNR Network. MHNRnetwork.com.